Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music, Dave.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
You wouldn't be able to do these awful things to me if I weren't still in this chair.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Who's in the box?
Put the gun down, baby.
No, what's in the box?
I said you give me the
what's
gun.
In the box?
Give me the gun.
Wolves have a territorial range of about 300 miles and a kill range of 30. If we're close to their den, and if we're within that radius, then they'll come after us. How can we tell if we're close? We can't.
What in God's name are you talking about?
Your son, Mr. Thorne. The son of the devil.
They're insane.
He must die, Mr. Thorne!
Do not want to go that way.
What's that way?
Officer, sir, you do not want to go that way. We're going to the mall.
Hello, Dexter Morgan.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And how's your buddy Dan?
He's also actually, I don't know. He was out of town last weekend, so I haven't seen him since we recorded.
Ah, very well, very well. And from the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, good evening.
Good evening.
All right. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Everyone's Dave here.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing good.
All right, very well. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I am great. I bought myself a big giant container of Halloween colored M&Ms, and I'm good to go.
Excellent, excellent. All right, so a couple of things. First off, who are we? For new listeners, our Dark Discussions podcast is a podcast that discusses a genre film weekly. So horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thriller, techno-thriller, mystery, grindhouse, cults, midnight movie, drive-in film, whatnot, and basically try to discuss this genre intelligently, basically. So a genre that deserves intelligence, in a sense. Eric, where can people find us on the web?
Oh, all sorts of places. But what you're probably trying to get me to talk about is our website, darkdiscussions.com. There's all sorts of stuff on this page. On the front page, on the right-hand side, you'll see links to Friends of the Podcast. Up at the top, we got a link to an articles page where there are articles written by myself as well as others. We have an audio link at the top that'll bring you to every single episode of this podcast, as well as any of the spinoffs available for free. And then on the front page, front and center, is a link to our Patreon account. Patreon is a service that allows you to financially support your online artists. If you would like to help us offset the cost of producing this podcast, because that's not free, you can go follow the link on the front page or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. And for every $5 a month that you care to donate to help us out, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the show. Every quarter, we take all the submissions from our patrons and draw them from a virtual hat to have a topic to do a show on picked by one of our patrons. So if you'd like to help support us, you can follow that link on darkdiscussions.com on the front page or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions.
Woo!
That's right. All right. Our email is darkdiscussions@AOL.com, and our Facebook group is Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook Group. Congratulations to co-host Mike's wife, Pam, for coming in the top 7 at a huge poker tournament, World Series of Poker tournament out in Foxwoods, Connecticut. And speaking of Pam, the reason I brought her up is she requested us to give a date when we record, and this is August 28th, 2019, Wednesday, basically around 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Let's see. We do have...
Yeah, so if everything sounds different tonight, it's because we're recording on Wednesday, so we're not in our usual Thursday voices.
Right.
That's right. That's right.
We sound a little less soulless this time around.
We do have a message from Mr. Dustin Watson of the Watsy genre podcast.
It's discussing horror movie podcast. That genre.
Yes, very well. Very well, very well.
They won't find it if they search for that. That's all.
That's true. That's true. He has some stuff to talk about with our episode 398, Melancholia. We do have some... emails and a voicemail, one voicemail from Sean Fox and two emails from Dan of the Horror Mafia podcast, as well as Kevin Letts, who has been a friend of our podcast for years and has grew up with Eric when he was a youngster. And then we have a couple of other quickies from Facebook as well and whatnot. So, I guess we could discuss what this episode is. This is, I guess, Mike, what is this episode? What's going on?
This is episode 400, and that's because the previous episode was episode 399, and we had recorded 398 episodes prior to that one.
Hey, Mike, are you a math teacher?
And thus we are now at episode 400, and about a month and a half ago or so, we each submitted, what was it, three films?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's right.
Four films. So we each submitted the name of three films for listeners to vote on our Facebook page, to vote on which one do you want us to do for the 400th episode. And that's how we ended up getting tonight's topic, is with this particular 1980s classic horror film.
We actually added one other film for a total of 16 films on that poll for the Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, because one of our listeners and contributors on the Facebook page, Rick Sanchez, asked us once. He goes, "Hey, folks, long-time listener here, just wondering why you have never done an American Werewolf in London." So that film was added to our list.
Just to briefly touch on this, one of the reasons we haven't done an American Wolf Werewolf in London is that we generally try and we stay away from the movies that everybody has already talked about a million times. You know, like your Friday the 13th, The Nightmare on Elm Street, all those guys. And every 50 episodes or so, we'll do one of those movies and like put it up in the poll or decide amongst ourselves what we want to talk about. For a milestone episode, but in general, we try and stick with newer stuff that's a little more current. Or every once in a while, we'll dive into the bag of something from the past.
Right.
And
the,
then our,
the,
then our Patreon picks. So
right, the Patreon picks, which are every 3 months, right?
Yep.
So that gives four times a year where we could be doing a classic episode, and obviously the definition of classic depends on who the Patreon person is who picked it. And we've done things like The Lost Boys and Witchboard and
Devil's Advocate.
Devil's Advocate and not The Gate. The Ninth Gate was another one. And some of those are undisputed classics. I'm sure if we go through the list of 6 million submissions that we've had, American Werewolf in London is probably in there a few times. So there's always the chance that that will pop up. Shameless Horror, you could always submit your a payment to the Patreon and just, you know, if you'd like, and then you put American Werewolf in London for all of your choices and bump the odds of it being selected. I'm just saying, shameless plug. That's all, remastered. That's all I'm saying.
But I just want to get back to why we haven't covered that particular movie. It's not because we don't like it is the point I'm trying to make.
No, it's a lovely film. I don't know. Lovely is the right adjective there.
It's a fine film. There we go.
It's a fine film, right? It's, you know, yeah. Remains of the Day is a lovely film. This is a, you know, yeah.
Right, right. Now, let's see here. We'll discuss the 16 films that were on the poll, and then our topic for tonight, where one of us actually fought Sartre for the first time, and so that's exciting to hear that opinion. Some folks who are newer or whatnot, how the podcast came about. Oddly, Eric hasn't blown his happy birthday whistles like he sometimes does.
I thought about it. Awesome. I can't find it, so you're saved for tonight.
There you go. There you go. We didn't really promote the 400th that much because everybody was just way busy this last couple of weeks. But how the podcast formed, basically. Listening to podcasts way back, me, Eric, and Mike always listened to podcasts, and there was one podcast called Horror Etc., which got close to 300 and something episodes. Now they're, I guess, defunct, but they had a message board, and I decided that I thought maybe this would be kind of cool to do a podcast, so I posted on the message board specifically looking for two people. One was a San Francisco policeman who left voicemails for the Horror Etc. podcast many times, and then another individual from New York named co-host Mike. And co-host Mike, what happened, Mike? You saw the board, the comment or something? Mike?
Yeah. You don't need a noisemaker when you have the internet.
He's picking up my slack.
So, yeah, I thought you would message me on the Facebook page, on the internet forum, because that's how fucking old we are. Facebook was barely a thing at the time, and message boards were much more common. Which still, honestly, I prefer that format. But anyhow. And you had messaged me and you'd messaged Eric, and I don't know if you had messaged anyone else, and for some weird reason we accepted, thinking, well, this will be a thing that we'll do like five times and never do again with strange people that we'll never meet in person. And,
well,
you know,
my story is a little bit different, which is that when Dark Discussions first started, I think the very first episode, Phil actually had a different co-host. And then that didn't work out. And Phil ended up doing several episodes solo. And I was listening to the show, and I felt bad for him. Because it seemed like he got left all alone, and then he was kind of doing episodes sporadically with Mike. And I was like, oh, that's a drag. He doesn't have a consistent...
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
No, that's not how that came out wrong. I meant the fact that he didn't have a co-host sometimes was a drag. So I reached out to him. I was like, hey, because on Horror Etc. it was mainly Tony and Ted were the two main co-hosts. And then there was a guy named Doug who would come on sometimes. They referred to him as Sometimes Doug.
Sometimes Doug. His name is – that's his Christian name is Sometimes Doug.
So, and by the way, you can still hear Doug on the Midnight Drive-In podcast. But I reached out to Phil. I was like, hey, if you want me to be your Sometimes Doug, if you come up on a week where you don't have a co-host, let me know. I can fill in. And so I did that a few times. And then I think it was Mike that came up with the idea, like, how about we do all three of us at the same time? And we were like, what?
It was there was somebody else that was was that the Alien podcast?
I can't remember what like episode we did all three together was.
Like no, it was the top 10 Halloween show, yeah, because the Alien came a little later. Yeah.
All right.
So we're like, this is pretty cool. We should do it this way all the time, and we did. Yes.
Right, because that's kind of the way the two podcasts I've listened to the longest at that point were Horror Etc. and Bloody Good Horror, and I still listen to Bloody Good Horror. So we haven't outlived them yet. I don't actually know what episode number they're up to, though, because they often will go on a short hiatus. Mm-hmm. But Horror Etc. died around episode 400, something like that.
It was 374, I think.
Okay, so we've outlived.
We kind of podfaded, then came back for 2 years in a row. They did a Halloween episode, and then they just stopped altogether and officially said they were stopping that time.
Right, because they both had moved on to other things. And I know with other things that Anthony's moved on to, I have no idea what other things Ted has moved on to. And probably Ted, like life.
Ted doesn't want anybody to know the things he's into, so that's cool.
Yeah. Right. Bloody Good Horror is up to 536.
Yeah.
They had like a 200 episode lead, and now they're down to about 130. So we're catching.
Who's that?
Bloody Good Horror.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But they actually have like a website, and they're associated with, I think, Horror Hound magazine, and they actually get, I think, some. I think there's some financing actually involved with them.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. And then what happened was I was looking for some writers to write a couple of articles for the Dark Discussions website to maybe draw some people there. And Chrissy saw the ad for that, and she wrote an article for – what did you write an article for? You know.
I think I did write about Chernobyl Diaries. But I also wrote about the Zoomy doll. Maybe it was the Zoomy doll that I wrote about.
That was the first one. Yep.
That was the first one. I don't know if I ever wrote a second one, but somehow you guys asked me to come on for Chernobyl Diaries. And I'm not sure why. I don't know if Phil and I were talking about, oh my God, I'm such a Chernobyl nut or something. I forget what happened, but you invited me to come on the episode. And then I just kind of sporadically and to my honor got invited to do a few other things like Escape from Tomorrow and some other stuff where I had some area of experience. I'm not going to say expertise, but at least experience. And I maybe knew a little bit more about the subject matter than your average person. Let's put it that way. And so I was able to come on and do that. And then eventually, I think you just asked me to come on full time at some point. And I've kind of been here ever since. Even though some illnesses and things like that have kind of kept me in and out. But, so that's how I got here.
All right. And then Abe was in a writer's group with me, and I knew one of the guys that I guess the most successful guy, Greg Norris, in that group mentioned that you were or maybe it had been Doug Foria that mentioned you, Abe, had a blog website. And so I was reading it weekly, and I discovered that you were into anime. And I wanted to do an episode on this anime, and I tried to get Mike to do it a couple times. Gantz, yeah. And so I had you come on there, and then we slowly invited you to do a couple other episodes, and then you just stayed on. And there you go.
It was really cool. The very first episode I remember was doing for you guys was Your Next.
That's right. Yeah, that was the first one you came on with everybody. Yeah, and that episode actually came out before the Gantz episode too.
Gantz was putting this up for a while before we actually got it up.
Right, and the problem is that Abe couldn't leave because he didn't have a driver's license, so he was kind of stuck.
I do now, and I'm driving and shit. So,
and you're new. That's kind of gross.
Abe, I suggest get in your car right now and go. Before it gets any worse.
Lord. Just wait for it. I'm gonna run you guys over right next time in Mystic.
Oh, shit.
Sweet.
Shit.
I can't get out of this shitty world.
the Gantz episode, yeah, that was one of the episodes that were in the queue for a week we didn't record, and that's when that finally came out. A couple of things here off the topic, but somewhat humorous. Jason F. Storm, podcaster, posted on Dark Discussions podcast, and he said, "Don't be Phil, please don't be Phil." And it's an article that he just posted. It said, "Man arrested outside Taylor Swift's Rhode Island home accused of
an unconfirmed." He had a valid concern.
You could have got me arrested, you son of a bitch.
I know.
I thought that was extremely humorous when somebody did that meme, Phil. I just thought that was so cute. That was so, like, affectionate. You know, it was just like, let's all tease Phil. But I think it's pretty cool that you went to her house. You know what I mean?
Like, just mental illness.
No, it's just to check it out. I would have hey, listen, you don't want to hear about my mental illness because...
Yeah, you're right, I don't.
Yesterday, my husband and I got out of...
Why are you talking about it?
Got out of 47 meters down and decided to go back to this bank parking lot that I had been at 12:30 in the afternoon to hopefully find the dead bird that I had seen and photographed there, because Nathan wanted to get some more specifics about this bird corpse. So, you know, we can talk about mental illness all you want. I was out picking up bodies of dead birds in parking lots at 9:30 last night just because I want to.
Okey-dokey.
There you go.
Dead birds is a completely different episode.
On a side note, Leo Pond of the Dorkening podcast, who lives down in that area, he actually mailed me, and I got it today, a total surprise, basically a pick, that a guitar pick that Taylor Swift actually used. Basically, a friend of his was working at Home Depot in that Rhode Island town, and I was helping out a customer, and then the customer gave him the pick and said, "I'm Taylor Swift's father," which is kind of cool. So right from Taylor Swift's father. So so I have that pick now. It's a treasure, I must say.
I bet you the guy's name is George Henderson, and he doesn't even know Taylor Swift, and he just carries around guitar picks.
Well, the pick actually has the 1989 tour stuff written on it too, so it's pretty cool.
Pretty good pick.
So I appreciate that. Leo, he's a good man. He's a good man. He knew. He said Phil was a big fan. I'm going to send it to him. So anyway, back to the 400th episode here. So we have a couple emails. The first one is from Don Anelli from the Great Horror Mafia podcast. Unfortunately, they've slowed down on their recording because of some moves and things like that. But it's a great podcast.
That's been a trend amongst podcasts lately. Everybody's dialing it back a notch. I guess everybody's busy.
Yeah, maybe. Don's at podcast actually has been nominated for some awards. Congratulations to him and the crew. This is what he has to say. He goes, "Hey, guys, and Christy, Don and Ellie here. Just wishing you guys a special 400th episode. Congratulations. It's been a real blast to hear a part of your run, as the show is easily in the top five of my favorite genre podcasts, and you know how many I listen to.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Absolutely. Awesome. And he listens to hundreds. I mean, he sends out a Facebook post on everybody's new episode twice a week and stuff for like dozens of podcasts. So he's follows a lot of them. The support and interaction have been a lot of fun and makes me glad to be included in your circle of friends in any capacity. So keep up the amazing shows, and we'll still be here pimping out Dark Discussions 800th episode whenever that occurs."
Oh my Lord. Thank you, Don. That's very cool.
See, but here's the thing. Eric, I heard you say, "Oh God." Would you have thought you were going to be at 400?
Probably not.
Well, the reality is every 2 years, I mean, right, every year we get a tentpole one, and every 2 years we hit a centennial, if you want to call it that. So in 2021, we're going to hit episode 500, and it would actually be cool if we could because I'm pretty sure we're still going to be cracking it. It would be cool if we could do something super special for that.
Yeah, but he's talking about 800. And to what Mike just said about it, I didn't think I'd be 400. Now I know what 400 is like. And we're talking double that.
Actually, Eric, you've done 800. Actually,
That's true. I got another podcast I've done a bunch of.
That's what we could do. We could do two episodes a week.
By the time we get at the rate we go, by the time we get to 800, I'll be in a wheelchair and you guys will be heads in the tubes.
All right. Well, anyway, we got another email from Kevin Letts. And this is what he has to say to the DP group. Congratulations on making it to 400 episodes. I'm proud to say I've listened to all of them. I don't remember them all, but I know I've listened to all of them. Congrats on making it this far. You've made DDP a fantastic podcast with your intelligent talk about the genre that deserves intelligent discussion. You have made so many episodes that have made long days seem short and enjoyable, as well as a 40-plus to and from work, something to look forward to. You have become friends of mine, except Eric, who I've been friends with since before I can remember. And for that, I am grateful. Here's to your next milestone, your faithful listener, Kevin Letts.
And let me say, Kevin.
Thank you,
say
Kevin.
Kevin, for listening to all 400 episodes, I would just like to say I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I actually kind of did that, I think, with the horror, et cetera, all their episodes, except for maybe the last, like, 30 or something.
Yeah, and there were even those some episodes I didn't get to of theirs. I listened to a lot of them, but I didn't hit all 376. I probably hit about 350.
Yeah, they did some episodes on Italian horror, and I was like, maybe not.
And there's a lot of films that I wanted to see, you know, like, which we tell people all the time, right? We're going to spoil the shit out of the film, so don't listen if you don't want to be spoiled. And there were things I didn't want to be spoiled about, and I still actually have them saved on my phone. I have the episode.
Good thing, because the podcast is pretty hard to track down at this point.
But yeah,
takes some effort.
Yep, it's true. And then we have a voicemail from Sean Fox. But before we play that, just a couple of things from the folks on the Facebook group. Some quickie one-line shots from a few folks. Chris Genro, congratulations, guys. Wow, crazy 400 episodes and still going strong. David Koning. Dude, to think I have known you, Phil, as long as this show has been on is incredible. Yeah, he was like one of our first emailers, as a matter of fact. Him and a guy from Canada, Dan, I think, out of Canada. He closed all his Facebook and all that, so hopefully he's doing all right. I haven't heard from him for a while. But Dave Koning, still hear from him strongly. Anthony Thurber, congratulations on 400 episodes. Sari Jokinen, I hope I pronounced that correct, but she's been one of our longtime listeners as well from Finland. Wow, congratulations. My favorite genre film podcast. Nice work you have done. Appreciate it. Amy Schiffs-Rain, who's one of our newer listeners, but one of our greatest contributors on the Facebook group, simply says congratulations. And she emails the show often. Leo Pond of The Dorkening, who I just mentioned, he says congratulations. The great actor Dan Lynch says outstanding. And Holly Masiak, who, by the way, has just started her own podcast, probably episode 5 or 6 now. Eric, what's that called?
Horror Melee?
That's right, Melee. Yep, and she says big congratulations. So thank you, folks. And then we'll play Sean Fox's message here. I'll just plug it in, and then we'll come right back.
Hello to Phil, Eric, Mike, Kirsty, and Abe. Congrats on hitting number 400 with the Dark Discussions podcast. If you were converting it to Canadian, I'm pretty sure it's like you've done 530 podcast episodes. I just wanted to offer my sincere thanks to you all for all the amazing episodes you have given us over the years, all the way back to May 2011 to the present day. It is hard to believe that back in 2013, a wacky Canadian ginger wildling stumbled upon your podcast because of the Chernobyl Diaries, episode 76. Christie was a guest then, whose knowledge and storytelling ability would soon evolve to be truly appreciated at its current status. Christie as the go-to for symbolism and deeper perspectives on the movies and topics you cover. I loved the Chernobyl Diaries episode so much that I went back all the way to the start with the State of Horror episode number one, and I have happily listened ever since. The endless hours of entertainment, informative banter, and laughs are truly priceless, as is the chance to chat with you guys over your sister podcasts, You Know Nothing Jon Snow, Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, and Searching for American Gods. I could rant and rave my adulation for your efforts for hours on end, but they would never truly do justice for all you have done. Dark Discussions has become far more than a podcast or a Facebook group. It has become a part of my listening life, and one I'm very grateful to have. I thank you for touching on tough topics like depression and suicide. I love that even when you disagree, you can do so with respect. I love that you are not about getting over by hurting or harming others. You know your quality, and you honor it with every show. You are fantastic souls who truly bring something to a world that can be very tough and challenging on a daily basis. Thank you, Phil, for always advising on the ancestral heritage of the actors and actresses in the movies that you, and shows that you watch, for being Auntie Danny, for all the messenger chats you had to put up with on Game of Thrones with me, for sometimes calling me Scott, for your unbridled enthusiasm on how this is the best movie ever. Also, for your concern about animals during movies, much like myself. By the way, when is your Taylor Swift and Sophie Jonas podcasts going to be released? Thank you, Eric, for coining the statement that will live with me forevermore. People suck. Thank you for the She's a Witch and the Wicca 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 Wikipedia catchphrases. Thank you for challenging Phil when World War II discussions and analogies are plentiful. I love Phil's sidetracking, but I respect how you try to refocus the good ship DDP and do it in a fun way. I also thank you for reading my Tolstoyan emails and somehow surviving. So kudos to you. Thank you, Mike, for stirring up the Chucky Canadian Ginger Midgets controversy. Thank you for your cats and hilarious school updates. Thank you for being the maester of the DDP podcast empire. Thank you for being the soul of it, and thank you for engaging Phil in many a great bantering that is the magic of DDP. Thank you, Christy, for being the initial reason I even listened to the DDP podcast. Thank you for all of your thoughtful insights and your own brand of infectious enthusiasm. Thank you for your fun stories and your impressive perspectives that you share that truly, really add so many more dimensions to the stuff that we watch. Thank you, Abe, for being the youth movement of DDP, for making me feel like an old guy. Thank you for your insight in the anime and manga sides of the genres, for your witty commentary, and for many great posts on the Facebook page. There's far more I could expound on all of you, but this is already becoming its own entity. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I can't wait for Dark Discussions podcast episode 500 and beyond. You guys have lasted longer than a lot of different podcasts along the way, and I think it is because you are genuine in who you are and what you represent. I thank you again, Phil, Eric, Mike, Christy, and Abe, for being beacons of goodness in a not always good world. I thank you for all your time, efforts, and financial investments you have made to bring us Dark Discussions podcast in all its versions and forms. My hope is that one day I will get to meet you all in person in Mystic, to buy you all the beverage of your choice, and to thank you in person for all that you do. Take care, and until next time, or at least episode 500, it is the Canadian Ginger Wildling signing out. Sean from St. Albert, Alberta, Canada.
All right. Thank you, Sean Fox. Appreciate it. It was always good to hear from Sean. Sean's been one of our biggest supporters for a long time, and he actually has become pretty friendly with a few of us on instant message, as a matter of fact. I know he was talking to you, Christy, a lot too, right?
Oh, yeah. And I actually need to apologize to him for that, because we started with a Chernobyl discussion follow-up of each episode, and then things kind of got insane in my life with my book launch and the post follow-up to that. And I just kind of like, I don't know, I fell off the face of the earth. So I feel really freaking bad about that. But anyway, we were having a very awesome conversation before that because he is super cool. So that's really all I wanted to say.
He's a great guy, and I discussed with him a lot about Game of Thrones through instant message as well. All right,
you know, so, I think you might like Game of Thrones.
Yes, that is true, Eric. That's true. I was actually wearing my Team Sansa shirt just 2 days ago during my football draft, as a matter of fact.
That's
for luck. All right, and actually, as we're recording, we actually got another message from Holly Masiak and another voicemail. Cool. So cool. Let's hear what she has to say. It's a 400th episode. Congratulations, maybe, I think. So, all right, here we go.
Hello, everyone at Dark Discussions. This is Holly Masiak. I wanted to give you all a huge, huge congratulations on your 400th episode. You all have consistently put out great quality work, and you were one of the first podcasts that I came across and got me wanting to podcast. And I'm always excited when a new movie of yours comes out. And I've seen, a new podcast about a movie comes out. And I've seen so, so many movies that I don't think I originally would have had you not done an episode on them. So congratulations again, and hopefully I have another 400 episodes to listen to. Great job, guys.
All right. Very good. All right. Thanks a lot, Holly Mason.
Thank you, Holly.
And people should check out my podcast out. And once again, Eric, what's your podcast again? It's Horror Melee.
Horror Melee, although they just did an episode about X-Files. So that
yes,
was,
I'm
that
so
was a
excited. But yeah, I can't wait. Like, watch that. Yeah, but there's a lot of X-Files episodes that were really strongly based in horror.
Yeah, like the
definitely.
The Host and Home.
Yeah.
Squeeze, Tombs.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a lot of scary stuff in X-Files. And she specifically pointed Chrissy out, even though all of us have pretty much seen every season of the X-Files, except maybe the reboot one.
It's girl power, man.
But
it's girl. She knows I have a very special place in my heart for X-Files. It was probably one of the shows in my adulthood, which there weren't many in my adulthood, that just really sucked me in and like kind of made me the person that I am today with regard to my writing and stuff. So that's probably why she tagged me, because she's awesome.
God, I hope it was one of the early seasons and not like any of the ones with Daggett.
I think it was season 5. I think a Detour, if my memory serves me correctly.
I really love season 3 was one of my favorites. But I like season 4 too. It just kind of felt like to me after season 5, after the movie came, then it kind of got a...
Ironically, is about the time I got Pam, my wife, into the X-Files, because that was around the time we met.
Right. I actually.
So are you saying it's her fault?
Yeah, pretty much.
All right.
That's the rule around here.
I got season 1 as a birthday gift. I had never seen any of the episodes, and the show was already off the air at that time. And then so I watched that, and then all the seasons you could get for $15. So I just watched them all, like binge them. So
cool.
I didn't watch him during. Yeah, I didn't watch him during the show.
So go go listen to Holly talk about him on her podcast, Horror Melee.
Yep, and thank you once again, Holly. All right, so basically, we have our fourth episode. As Chrissy said, we pick a tentpole during these big episodes, and as Eric and Mike and Abe mentioned, we have the poll. And let me read the first, the 15 losers. And that was Dead of Night, a 1945 film. Curse of the Demon, based off of M.R. James's short story, Cast in the Runes, and starring Dana Andrews. The Stephen King adaptation Cujo. The Thing from Another World, the sci-fi horror film. The French horror film Inside. Naomi Watts's The Ring. George C. Scott's The Changeling, Kevin Dillon's The Blob, Wes Craven's Scream, Gina Davis' film Beetlejuice, Donald Sutherland's Invasion of the Body Snatchers, John Cassavetes' film Rosemary's Baby, Sean Cunningham's film Friday the 13th, David Cronenberg's film The Fly, John Landis' film American Werewolf in London are the losers. And then the film that won the poll and is our topic tonight. So, Eric, why don't you everybody know what we're discussing tonight?
Tonight, we're going to be talking about Evil Dead 2.
That's what we saw.
Legend has it, it was written by the Dark Ones, Philippidus Taylor Swiftidus.
that's my favorite joke you've ever made, eh?
That is amazing. That's fucking awesome.
That was good.
Legend has it that it was written by the Dark Ones, Necronomicon Ex Mortis. Roughly translated, Book of the Dead. The book served as a passageway to the evil worlds beyond. It was written long ago, when the seas ran red with blood. It was this blood that was used to ink the book. In the year 1300 AD, the book disappeared.
Dead 2 is technically a sequel to Evil Dead, though it's almost like a
remake.
Semi-remake. 1987 came out. I actually saw it at the theaters, believe it or not. It stars Bruce Campbell, among others. It's produced by Robert Tappert, written by Sam Raimi and Scott Spiegel. Scott Spiegel has done a number of screenwriting and directing as well, including Hostel Part 3. The music is by Joseph LaDuca, who's done pretty much all of Robert Tappert's films. And one last person of note I want to bring up was Peter Deming, cinematographer, who basically made his name from this film and has done most of Sam Raimi's films, but since then, he has also done David Lynch, Wes Craven, Jay Roach, among other folks. He actually did Mulholland Drive, for example. So this film has brought a lot of people to huge things, because prior to this, they were mostly all indie filmmakers or actors, and this film pretty much made them get into Hollywood and become who they are today. Now, I guess we can go around and discuss how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. I'll start, since I mentioned that I had seen it at the theaters. Yeah, believe it or not, this film actually had trailers on TV, and the trailers looked awesome. I just remember the line, "I'll swallow your soul," and then you go, "Swallow this." And so me and all my buddies at the age of 17 said, "No, we're going to go see that film." And we did see it, and I don't know how we got in, because I think you had to be 18, but I don't know. But either way, we watched it, and there wasn't too many folks in the theater. But
I believe this was actually released unrated, Phil.
Yes, it was. It was rated nothing intentionally. So I don't know how we got in, because I didn't even have a card in us. Yeah. And the film was awesome. I love this film. This film is kind of known as a car comedy, but I was freaked out. I thought it was scary as hell. The atmospheric.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, I thought it was scary. I thought it was atmospheric. I thought it was it played all the horror cards correctly. And then over the years, oddly, it's now considered more of a comedy than a horror film, and I've always loved this film because of the horror tropes in it rather than the comedy, even though the comedy is good as well. So when we did our Halloween top 10 episode, the first episode we all did together, or me, Eric, and Mike did together, I had this as my 11th film, and I almost put it on, but I didn't. So it didn't make it, but it was one of the films I had possibly going to be listed as one of my top 10 horror films of all time. Yeah, I love this film. It's fantastic. Let's go to the person who saw it for the first time and I think may agree with me, and that's Chrissy.
Hi. Yeah. This is super interesting because my first exposure to this movie, I have never seen this before, and I still have yet to see the original Evil Dead. But when Army of Darkness came out, I went to see that and in the theater when it came out. And I had no idea whatsoever that that movie was connected to these movies. Because like I said, those of you who've heard this podcast know, I did not grow up seeing horror films. But it just wasn't my thing. My parents wouldn't let me, so it was kind of out of my realm. Which makes it so much nicer as an adult, to be honest with you. But anyway, I saw this, and I just remember thinking it was one of the funniest things I had ever seen in my life. Anyhow, so I go to watch this with Nathan, and we had to rent it because Nathan owns all of these, including the TV series on DVD, except for Evil Dead 2. So we ended up renting it. Yeah, he has them all.
Ow.
He's got... I don't know. He just says I must have never bought it because, like, he has Evil Dead. He has Ash versus the Evil Dead, the TV series.
The remake of Evil Dead?
I don't think so. I didn't ask him. He just said he came upstairs and he says, I have every fucking one except Evil Dead 2. Don't ask me why.
That's said, so bizarre.
That is weird.
Because it's generally considered to be the best and probably the most popular of the three films. So
yeah,
that's just really strange.
Yeah, it is his favorite. Now, with all due respect, I love my husband dearly, but his DVD video collection is an absolute disaster. So
you mean he doesn't have it shelved alphabetically by title as it should be?
Yes, it's a complete mess.
Okay. I'm surprised Charles didn't have
boxes and no, Charles doesn't have any of these actually. But anyway, I suspect that he probably does or did have Evil Dead 2 at some point and it's lost or he loaned it to someone and he moved a lot of time. My husband moved he's moved quite a few times over the years. In fact, my house is the longest he's ever been living anywhere and that's 12 years.
Is his name really Nathan?
It is really Nathan.
Well, he doesn't know what it used to be. The name got lost somewhere along the way, and just Nathan's what stuck.
But anyway, so I saw this, and I don't know. It's going to be interesting, my feelings on it, I think. I personally, it scared the living shit out of me. So I'm sure you guys are going to be interested to hear about that, since some of the effects now would be by some standards, I think, considered kind of cheesy. I thought that they were so effective, a lot of them. So anyway, that's it. So that's how I heard about this film. I really enjoyed it. I had fun with it. And I think my favorite parts were the parts that really terrified me the most, which I will talk about when we get into spoiler territory.
Right, you better.
All right, Mike.
This was actually playing for about a minute and a half in the movie theater I worked in when I was 16. And unfortunately, I remember the poster being in the theater, but it was came and went before I had a chance to watch it. I remember seeing it reviewed on At the Movies, when it was Siskel and Ebert, and surprised that they gave, I'm pretty sure it got two thumbs up as a horror film. I remember them showing the footage of Linda's corpse dancing, the stop motion, and they were praising the visuals. So that was like the first part of it I'd seen. I'd never seen the original Evil Dead until I went to college. And so I caught up with Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 through the video rental store. And I love both films. I think the first one is much more straight horror and sometimes unintentionally comedic because some of the effects haven't aged well and it is being seen on high definition 4K when it's not meant to. And here the humor is a little bit more deliberate, but it will very quickly switch from stuff that's silly and over the top to stuff that I think in the right setting and the right mindset can be legitimately scary. Whereas opposed to Army of Darkness is just pure Three Stooges. So I really liked this film a lot. And it really just amazing watching it and watching how well crafted it is and how inventive Sam Raimi is in a lot of the things he does. And there is a reason why he is who he is, I guess.
Yep. All right. Let's go with Eric.
I can't remember in which order the Evil Dead movies came to me. Because there was a period in the 90s. I did enjoy horror movies when I was younger, but I didn't get to see a whole lot of them because I wasn't old enough to go to the movies by myself. And my mom thought going to the theater was a drag most of the time. So after I finally was like on my own and owned a VCR for the first time in the 90s, there was a period of time where I just went through the horror section at the video store, and the Evil Dead series was one of the things I caught up on. And I'm probably going to come in on this movie lowest amongst us tonight. And that's not to say I don't like the movie, because I do. But amongst the Evil Dead trilogy, I like it the least. And that's because I thought the original Evil Dead, it's like the prototypical indie horror movie, right? Clearly low budget, but trying to scare you and a lot of times succeeding. And then Army of Darkness, like Chrissy was talking about, is very, very funny, and ultimately quotable. And I love that movie for that reason. This movie, whereas Mike was just talking about it going from being humorous to being generally scary, I agree with him, but I find that to be a negative rather than a positive, because the inconsistent tone of this movie bugs me a bit. And there are some other smaller issues I have with the movie as well that we'll get into later. I will say that upon rewatching it this week for this 400th episode, I was particularly astounded by some of the camera work in this movie. There's some amazing stuff going on with the camera work in this movie. So I like it, but I like it the least of the Evil Dead series.
All right. Very well. All right, Abe.
So I heard about this film way back when I was younger. My folks had, the original Evil Dead. We had got a copy of Army of Darkness, and we also had a VHS copy of Evil Dead 2. I think the order was I saw the first Evil Dead, and then I saw Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness. So I saw in the order from when they were released. I always thought the first Evil Dead was, while a lot of things are kind of dated and some moments are kind of unintentionally goofy, there are some pretty visceral scenes. The tree rape scene, the pencil in the ankle, some of the makeup effects are really creepy and stuff like that. So it was, for me, it was straight horror with a few exceptions. This one had me laughing my ass off. Just as much, if not more, than Army of Darkness, because there were some scenes that were just great. The severed hand running amok, the laughing objects, some of the props and effect fails, it was just so much fun. It was just a goofy ride, but it brought to life the iconic, character of Ash, and of course the cult figure that we know and love as the Chin of Greatness, Bruce Campbell. There's a couple of moments that actually did kind of creep me out. I always thought Henrietta was really creepy, and Just some of the Uncanny Valley moments with some of the effects, like the stop motion, really did some actually work. But for the most part, I just had a lot of fun with it. It's just, you know, it's a well-paced dark horror comedy with, you know, a real sense of fun to it. And I can, you can definitely tell the creators had just as much fun as making it as they did in just how it exudes that kind of goofy Three Stooges horror. You know, which is kind of an interesting comparison when you learn about the backstory of the very first Evil Dead and how much of a nightmare it was for them to try to finish towards the end. If I was to rank it, that's tough because I love the Evil Dead, but the Evil Dead 2 is a lot more fun, and Army of Darkness is just, you know, adventure, goofy, fun as well. So it's like I can't really choose a favorite, but if I was to choose one as on a desert island to watch, I think this might be the one, Evil Dead 2.
All right, very well. Now, Eric, do we have a wiki for this one here?
Wiki. I'm actually stalling because I forgot to bring it up. Sorry, I was unprepared. All right. Here we go. The lone survivor of an onslaught of flesh-possessing spirits holes up in a cabin with a group of strangers while the demons continue their attack.
Pretty much.
Yeah, that's good. The thing that's sickening about this is that this movie is now 32 years old. It's crazy.
Oh, goodness.
I remember seeing it at the theaters. It's just, jeez, yeah, we're old.
I'm old. Phil's older.
I'm
the oldest, you're right, because Mike is just a few months younger than me, and then everybody else is younger. Speaking of Necronomicon, very coincidental, Chrissy, you were at the Necronomicon convention, and
this plays a big part. Necro.
Whatever.
Abe's right on this one.
So, yes, I was at Necronomicon this weekend. Necronomicon is a biannual 4-day conference that celebrates all things Lovecraft. There are bus and walking tours of the city. There are horror short film festivals going on all weekend long. There are panels all weekend long. There are live performances. There are social events such as, raves and parking lots, and also the Eldritch Ball, which is a big formal costume ball. It's a really wonderful, wonderful con. And there is something for everyone. The next one will be taking place in 2021. And it just gets bigger and bigger every single year. So your best bet, if you want to go, is get a weekend long general pass. Spend the extra money to get a ticket for the ball. The ball is an event not to be missed. There are some things that do require a little extra money, like the bus and walking tours, but it's like 10, 15 bucks if you want to do that. I basically barely did any of it this year, because there's just so much. There's also an art show. So if you love art shows, this is definitely the place to be. It's a good thing I didn't have any money, because I would have bought so much stuff. It would have been, you know, ridiculous. But yes, I highly recommend it. And anyway, that's the Necronomicon. It celebrates Lovecraft. It's pretty fabulous.
Yeah. And since this movie has the Abe to make you happy Necronomicon book in it, and Outer Beings, some people like to say that it's a spinoff of the Lovecraft mythos, but it's very loosely based on those things. All right, so what do we guys want to talk about before we get into spoilers and things? Again, it's a 32-year-old film, so I'm not too worried about spoiling as much as some of the newer films.
Right.
Yeah, so I think the first thing is that for anybody, you know, it's called Evil Dead 2, for anybody who's never seen it or never heard of it, which is, you know, how have you ever at least heard of it, the film. It might get a little confused watching the films in order because, well, they do take off from where the first one ended, but how they get there is basically very, very different. But the setup is kind of the same. So the folks go up to a...
I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were going to go into a plot. Go ahead.
Oh, basically, the setup is some teenagers go up into a cabin, they find a Book of the Dead, they fuck around with it, and demons, or in this case, deadites, are unleashed and start possessing everybody. By the end of the film, only one person is alive, which is Ash Williams, played by Bruce Campbell. However, basically, in the first film, it's a little larger cast. In this case here, it's only his girlfriend, Linda. But it's... So, it, you know, it's... But they do kind of like a quick, like... Get, it's almost like, I don't know, 3 minutes of the setup for the, this film to get us to basically where the first film cuts off, which is Ash being attacked by the dark force that lurks in the forest in that classic basically attacking POV camera movement.
And the reason they did it like this is because they actually did not own the rights to the first movie anymore, so they couldn't show actually footage from the first film, so they had to reshoot it, and that's why you get Bruce Campbell back as the lead, but his girlfriend Linda is played by a different actress, and the beginning of the movie is almost like a quick remake of the original Evil Dead, and Abe's right, if you're watching these in order, it's a little disconcerting. I know the first time I saw it, I got a little confused. I was like, what is going on here? And then I got the explanation of why they had to do that.
Yeah, when I finally watched the first one years later, I was surprised too, because I found out that this film here, Evil Dead 2, is more of the greatest hits from the first in a more interesting story. And so it almost felt like it was an afterthought that they decided to make it, quote unquote, a sequel to the first. And then there's been a running joke all these years after that. Poor Ash forgot about his first.
He's so stupid he went back to the cabin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which of course isn't really the case. I think it was like more like, you know, let's just use the name Evil Dead and call it a sequel, even though it's really a remake or a better version of the first film. I don't know, but...
Now, the recap of the first film's plot is relatively quick, though.
Yeah, as I said, it only takes like 3 minutes.
But by the time Ash, I think, says the line about the sunlight or the daylight chasing it away, I paused it, and it was at 10 minutes. And that was,
yeah.
Would have been after, of course, the...
opening credits,
the opening monologue, yeah. And the thing about the book and the opening credits. So I would say probably closer to about 7 minutes, maybe 8 minutes at the most. And I've heard some people try to say Evil Dead 2 is a remake of Evil Dead.
That's, which I just think factually incorrect.
Yeah,
because if you look at the credits in the end, it specifically calls it a sequel to the Evil Dead.
Well, the title is Evil Dead
2.
Two. And they only recount, I mean, they, like you said, they do a greatest, not even a greatest hits, right? Because they leave out a lot of great stuff from the first
film. They do.
Yeah.
Still worth watching the first, sure.
And even though they do repeat some of the gags, like the tree, but I actually, as much as I love this film, I'm kind of with a couple of you in that this is, I think, my least favorite of the three. I don't mind the juxtaposition of the humor and the horror normally. I don't mind it here. I think it's, in hindsight, it's partly this opening, which I just found so jarring the first time I watched it, that it was a little confusing. And that feeling never quite, even though I understand it, a little bit of that residual
it's,
is still there.
It's a bit jarring, yeah.
And I still, I don't think it has as good a story as the others. It's visually inventive, has some great moments. It never stops. It goes in, gives just great set pieces for 90 minutes, and then gets out. But I don't think you ever get to know the characters very well. Mm-hmm. There is no real emotional relationship between the characters, you know, which I think you kind of had more in the first film.
Right.
And even in the third film, there is a story there for Ash with actual character development, even if he is a dumbass through most of it. but that's also something that's played just for laughs. And it's a credit to this film that it's so unconventional, I think, in its story structure.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, this is like the ultimate Cabin in the Woods movie, that it still works. And it's purely going on Sam Raimi adrenaline, right? On what's the next thing he can throw at you. And he keeps it going. You know, he is mm-hmm. everything, you know, whether it's, you know, the killer hand, the crazy trees, the, you know, Henrietta in the basement. You know,
the gothic stuff from like old Vincent Price stuff with like the moving lamps and the animal head moving and things like that.
Yeah, right. It just you never really know where it's going to go next. And mm-hmm. by the time you are three quarters of the way through the film, you know, it's so weird. Ash is born three quarters of the way through the film. Right, the Ash that everybody mm-hmm. knows.
Yeah,
the Ash up Groovy. To the moment, up until the classic Sam Raimi montage and him saying
Groovy.
It's not the Ash that you would recognize if all you've seen is Army of Darkness and Ash versus Evil Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's when Ash becomes Ash. He's got the Ash look. He's got, you know,
the chainsaw hand, the boomstick, and
the boomstick. Before that, he has a shotgun. Then he makes a boomstick.
Right.
you know, he has a chainsaw in his hand. It is not his hand.
Uh-huh.
It's something he carried. So, yeah, and it changes, right? And actually, up to that point, you could question who's supposed to be the hero of the film. Because you're never really sure what's going to happen with Ash because he's possessed and
yeah. And there's and again, I do like this movie. I'm going to criticize it a little bit tonight, but one of the things is like Bruce Campbell has a particular skill set. If you need somebody to make an ass of himself, Bruce Campbell. If you need somebody to beat the shit out of himself, okay, Bruce Campbell. If you need somebody for dramatic acting, maybe not Bruce Campbell. So there are a couple of scenes early in the movie where Sam Raimi tried to make Bruce Campbell actually like cry, and it's just like, oh, really?
No, Bruce Campbell is a charming walking piece of ham and cheese.
Yeah,
you know, he's literally like if a ham and cheese sandwich had a chin and was carrying a chainsaw around, that is Bruce Campbell.
Basically, I've seen the comparisons to his acting with John, but it was more like the California pretty boy, and Bruce Campbell's more of the man's man look, but very similar, where it's a lot of being Yeah, exactly. A lot of physical comedy, a lot of self-deprecating comedy, and also a lot of I guess, you know, dropping things, being incompetent, things of that nature.
Well, and I will say that in Evil Dead 2, that scene where his hand is possessed, and he's just beating the absolute shit out of himself.
Yeah, I love that.
One of the more entertaining things I've ever seen. I could watch it on a loop many, many, many times before I got tired of it.
I just love, I mean, especially when he's just breaking plates over his head.
Well, and then when he's unconscious, and the hand of its own volition starts inching him across the floor,
and that is a fantastic physical performance.
It is,
because he's got, I don't know what, if somebody's pushing him, if he's dragging himself,
mm-hmm.
But you know, he's got to have, you know, keep his entire body and his face completely passive. Dead to the world while he is using his hand to drag him. And I don't know if, I mean, you don't see his lower half, so maybe he's kicking himself up with his feet. Maybe, you know, Ted Raimi is there shoving him along.
Right.
You know, but he's got
it. We don't know for sure.
But yeah, he is fantastic at that. He does such a fabulous job, all of the stuff with his hand and acting with his hand.
Another thing I really love too is just knowing that not only Bruce Campbell has to brutalize himself, but Sam Raimi, according to the commentary stuff, just really took pleasure in just putting him through the ringer.
Oh, that, Sam Raimi loves to torture Bruce Campbell.
Oh, yeah. Like that scene, so basically the scene where he's being possessed, at the basically where they're supposed to be carrying off from the very first film, and he's flying through the forest, and the branches are hitting him, and that's Sam Raimi in the corner whacking him with the branches.
Yeah.
They take a great pleasure in it.
Right. Yeah, he wasn't nice to him on the set of the original Evil Dead either.
No, but that entire experience was not kind to anybody, because that, you know, they were all covered in corn syrup, it was freezing cold, most of the cast had departed, and those contact lenses they used with the Deadites were apparently murder on them.
Yeah, I don't think anybody ever liked wearing those things.
There was a great shot early in where I think when he's unpossessed, where you see the cloudiness clear away from his eye.
Yeah, that was a good shot. I know.
And again, this is I hate saying this because such an easy thing to do, but that's the kind of thing that now they would do with CGI.
Mm-hmm.
And just watching it, I have no idea how they pulled that off.
Me neither, honestly.
Yeah, I would agree. That was something that I honestly was so impressed with this movie, was that there were some things that, some special effects that were just really well done, and there were some that were jerky because they were pre-CGI, mm-hmm. but it almost, because of that, they were so effective. Like, that scene where he's sitting there and he has the nightmare.
Yeah.
And he envisions his dead girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
like, out there jerking around in the woods doing that creepy ballet dance.
Mm-hmm.
That kept me awake all night. That image kept me awake all night. I could tell it was jerky. It was very Ray Howard, Harryhausen.
Yep.
But there was something in the way it moved that was so unsettling and so fucked up that I was almost like, oh my God, it's not even like bad.
It's like I'm out of a bad dream. Like it was,
yeah, it was really disturbing. It was awesome. It's one of the scariest things I've seen in a long time.
Well, and in addition to the effects, there's the camera work in this movie is astounding. And I think it might be immediately that eye clouding or unclouding scene that we just talked about. There was a shot right after he becomes unpossessed where the camera is close up on his face and just goes spiraling up into the air backwards. And I'm like, how the fuck did they even do that? I don't understand how that's physically possible.
Or that continuous shot where Ash is getting constantly chased through the house and they're going through every corridor.
Right.
And it is a one continuous shot. And
I loved that. I just thought that was fucking so awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, because
you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, and because Bruce has to keep his eye on, basically imagine he's being chased by some kind of demon, while also dodging through every narrow corridor. That, and it makes you wonder how much practice they had to do before they went for that, because it's just one shot.
There was a bunch of stuff in this movie that I was thinking about watching at this time, where they must have had to rehearse it. Like, there's a scene later in the movie where the entity is doing spooky stuff, but it's making noises throughout the room. And Bruce Campbell, and I can't remember the actress's name who plays the professor's daughter, but they're sitting there, and they're both, like, jerking in their heads and looking at the exact same spot throughout the room.
Oh, that's Sarah Berry.
And it's like six different places in a row, and they both look at the exact same place in the exact same order at the exact same time. There had to be some serious rehearsal for them to pull that off.
Yeah. And, you know, there's also just some, some really cool little tricks, like when they had the Ed character getting possessed, and he's kind of glides over to Bobby Joe, just kind of this little weird kind of like demon float, but they don't show his legs, so he's just kind of in one motion flying towards her. I also love the weird choice to have Henrietta's neck turn into this kind of weird serpentine snake.
That was
thing.
A weird choice, wasn't it?
It was.
And speaking of weird choices, the idea not only to have that happen, but at the end of the film to give it monkey noises.
Oh, it was weird.
What the hell was that?
Or even weirder was when they're in the first attack, when they're all sitting on top of the cellar doorway, and basically the creature's throwing the fit because it can't get out, and it sounds like Donald Duck having an aneurysm. It is some weird choices. There's some really weird stuff. And it's cool. Because it's so dark, but it does make you scratch your head, like, oh, what? Why?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when you talk about them that way, they never felt really weird to me, for whatever reason.
There were some weird choices, but I do think there were some genuinely frightening moments in the movie, too.
Yeah.
Like that big head thing at the end, I thought...
That was really awesome,
and of course the scene in the woods as well. The woods coming alive is kind of a frightening thing.
Oh yeah, there's the shot. Was it when they were going into the cabin, or was it just a shot of a tree shifting around?
Oh yeah, it's looking out the window, and the trees are kind of jerking. Yeah,
and there's one when they walk out of the cabin. I think it's when what the hell was it? Jake drags them out of the cabin at gunpoint, and they look up and they see the tree line, and the trees are moving. Completely unnecessary shot on a low budget film. You know that took some money because they had to build the model trees, and I'm not saying a fortune, but for a low budget film, every penny counts.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, just for like a 5-second scene, right?
Right, and then later on, they, you know, I think on their way back, or there's an establishing shot of the cabin and the tree outside, like
pulls its
fruits out. Again, it's not a necessary scene because you can do the final thing of the trees marching on the cabin at the end without that, but it just is just so weird and creepy and unsettling to do it that way, and again. Creative the way they do it, and it doesn't look completely real. Not that I think a tree doing that could ever look completely real,
right?
Yeah,
because trees don't do that.
But it is real enough. It is effective enough.
There's another cool scene I really loved where Jake gets pulled into the cellar, and it's just basically this geyser of blood just bubbling right out of the cellar. And it could have easily just been, you know, him just being pulled in, just horrible sounds coming in from it. But they go through this entire process where still clinging on to his, Annie Kenobi is holding on to Jake's legs, and there's blood just splashing at him, her. And it's just really, you know that took a lot to try to stage that too.
Well, and that's a Sam Raimi trademark, is the use of way too much blood when there shouldn't be that much blood. Like the other scene when Bruce Campbell is shooting at the hand in the wall.
Yes.
And then gets doused with, I think they were saying on the commentary they used 2 55-gallon drums full of blood water for that scene. That's a lot of blood.
Give him more. And I was actually going to mention two things. One, there's the when Jake first takes him out of the cabin, right? When he takes the notes and the trapdoor and throws the notes down, but you see Henrietta's still under there. And that was they didn't have to do it. It was a nice little touch to remind you that she's still there. I thought that was a great little thing. But I also, one of the things I was going to remark, it's almost like the first glimpse of the Ash that we know, which is when he's having the fight with his hand and he's shooting at it in the wall. And it gets caught in the mousetrap.
Oh, yes.
And that is his chance for any normal human being. It's trapped. Shoot it then. But in very much now classic Ash Williams style, instead of shooting it, he takes a moment to laugh at it and mock it. You know, it's a perfect example of his dumbass hubris.
Right.
You know,
I just love it. Just tops it off with the finger. The hand is giving him the finger. It's just like, why you little? It's, you know, and it's that moment between then and it's kind of interesting, kind of back and forth of when it gets tries to be more horror and more comedy, like the Linda parts where Linda is terrorizing him in his dreams and the body is attacking him and stuff like that. It's more straight up horror, along with him being chased through the house. But then we get to the hand sequence and also the household items laughing at him. It's kind of very straight, more comedy. And then it kind of goes back into horror of Henrietta coming, you know, back coming from up from the cellar and stuff like that. And it's kind of like an interesting back and forth of what is more horror and what is more comedy in their scenes.
Well, and there are places where I couldn't tell. And that was problematic for me personally. For instance, when he has his girlfriend's decapitated head in his lap, and she says something to him that's really kind of evil and spooky, and for that one moment I was like, oh, that's scary. But then he starts running around with his head attached to his hand, slamming it against everything, kind of like Three Stooges style. I'm like, what is this?
Like being attacked by a little dog.
I have to say that certain scenes were both horror and scary at the same time. Like you mentioned the head scene, but even you, Abe, you mentioned the house laughing at him. And I originally, at the beginning of that whole scene, I felt it was scary as hell when the deer
first come to life. That was creepy.
Yeah, that was creepy.
But, and they're all it's screaming, "I'll swallow your soul," and "Join us," and all this stuff, and it reminded me of the old horror films from William Castle and all those that spooked me out as a little kid, because they're all ghosts and spirits and all that and stuff. But then, of course, they have the laughing, and then the lamp goes up and down with him and stuff. So it lightens it a bit. So it's an interesting mix that horror and laughs are in the exact same scene, where the first part is one emotion and the second part of the same scene it's another emotion, and it's kind of interesting
thing as well is that the goofs, some of the technical mistakes are a little more obvious in this one. You can see catch numerous types of wires and stuff like that. Like when the Henrietta's eye pops out and flies into Bobby Joe's mouth, you can see it as flying, the little wire, the little stick at the bottom. Or
that was the only one that I felt was as obvious as you're implying, Abe. And again, that one you couldn't see when it was before HD.
Yeah. Well, there's even a more obvious one where Henrietta's attacking Annie, and as she's spinning around, you can actually see the back side of the costume wide open.
I know that's the case, but I didn't notice that until I watched a documentary and they pointed it out to me.
The other thing they point out, one of the things they point out in the commentary is when she's been around, there's one shot where if you pay close attention, and they mentioned it before it happened, so I was able to pay close attention and see it, and it's fucking gross. It's that Ted Raimi is actually the one that was in that costume.
Yeah.
And they were in a school gymnasium in I think South Carolina or something.
North Carolina.
Was it North Carolina? It was hot. Yeah. Is the point I'm trying to make. And he was literally sweating buckets inside that costume.
Oh yeah, I saw the behind the scenes. Yeah.
So there's one of the scenes where Henry Red is spinning around at the very end of one shot. You can actually see Ted Raimi's sweat pouring out of one of the ear holes of the costume. And it's just like, oh, man.
And poor Ted. I mean, not only was that costume blazing hot, but they tried one point to actually have Ted come out of the ground when Harry Enter resurrects, you actually by having him under some layer of dirt. And he did come up, but the problem was he was wearing those the contacts, and dirt got in his behind them.
Oh, no.
So they were all that dirt was grinding at his eye, and he was screaming bloody murder as he came out of the dirt. So which is why they kind of went with the stop motion.
And Sam Raimi was like, good, that's good, go with that.
You know, he's like, you can deal for you, big baby, come on. But that's why they went with the stop motion when the head pops up, because it was a little more safer for Ted, because it didn't work out the worst time. And you know, but I think it's one of the things I really love about these movies is just how much they put into it, even though they sometimes suffer for their efforts, because they went through a lot just to get this film made. Because not only couldn't get the rights to the first one, but they had to make up their own production logo, which was that little blood and flower and other things, just to kind of get the film off the ground. You know, they had to kind of start from almost from scratch because of what happened.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously that was a nod to Citizen Kane, the Rosebud, and stuff, because, you know, Raimi and Tappan and all them are big fans of Hollywood cinema yesteryear. But, yeah, I mean, not directly related to the film, but again, behind the scenes stuff, as you guys are discussing, the documentary for this film and the commentary for this film, this is like one of the best loaded discs, whether you get the DVD or the Blu-ray, about behind the scenes and the making of, and I think this may have been the main disc that got me into director commentaries and all the extras on discs, because prior to that, I hadn't seen anything like this yet. So it really gives you everything you want to know about the film, which is kind of interesting. But it doesn't really talk about, it's more of like a making of and stuff rather than the theme and things, because it doesn't talk about the history of the film as a horror film, and I thought that was kind of interesting as well. Since getting back to what Chrissy said and what I said earlier, there is a lot of stuff in this film that is pretty scary, from the setup with the Book of Blood and all that other stuff to the ghost scene of the dancing girl and all these other things. Now, Chrissy, you mentioned there were some other scenes that really spooked you out, and they're probably the same ones that spooked me out the first time I saw the film, too.
Yeah, I mean, the whole business with the deadites and the whited-out eyes, there is something about the soulless eye that is exceptionally disturbing. And I think no matter what context it's in, it's sort of like, you know, when you see like blind cavefish or something and they have like no pupils, or, you know, you look at the demon movies and when somebody's possessed, there's no pupil, there's no separation, it's just plain. Or like Quint says, like a doll's eyes, the shark's eyes, just totally black. I think that was a very simple effect, but I think it's because Raimi really used things that just typically disturb people. The reason why pupil-less blank eyes like that are scary is because what it suggests is that there is no soul inside. In other words, whatever is inside that person's body or that animal or whatever is being depicted is completely rote. It is very animalistic. It is going to do what is primal. It no longer has reason. And that is why I think that particular image is so disturbing, and probably why he chose it, because it's very universal. It upsets everybody when you see it. As I said, the jerky Harryhausen-esque motions of the girl doing the ballet dancing, I think they really worked, because like Abe said, they didn't really come across as, oh, this is a maquette, or this is how we used to do it before CGI. The very jerky movement of it just suggested a sort of strange, off-putting dream state. This scene where everything in the house is laughing at him. I, in particular, found the deer head on the wall laughing to be incredibly disturbing.
Yeah, that was
another image.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really haunted my dreams. I had nightmares about that. And that's because, I mean, let's face it, I don't know about you guys, but like, I've been in plenty of hunting lodges and things when I was a kid. I grew up in a farm town. You know, the heads on the wall like that are just scary. You know, they're unsettling anyway. And then you make them talk and stuff like they do in Disney's. I got news for you. They have these things in Disney's Country Bear Jamboree, and they talk and they're friendly and they're still creepy. So there's just, and they're the friendliest things ever. They're cracking jokes and being goofy, and they're still really scary. I thought that was very frightening. I particularly loved the way we got the point of view of the spirit moving through the woods. How we knew what was kind of going on in that house, or we knew where Ash was hiding, but we were sort of looking, chasing him from the point of view of the demon. I thought that was really effective and very terrifying.
Well, that's a Sam Raimi special that came from the original Evil Dead.
Okay, and see, because I did not yet see the original Evil Dead, that was why I didn't know that. I also liked about this film, on a little less scary note, it was a very simple story, and they suck you right into it.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
They don't screw around. They give you, like, 2 minutes of, here's this book.
Set up,
and
in
the
yeah.
1300s, it disappeared. Okay, thanks. That's enough. You know, we didn't have these, like, long preview sequences of what the hell was going on and stuff like that, which was good. I really did love the sounds that the demon made. I thought those were extremely effective. All of the breathing that was going on. And there were some funny little homages in here too, like Baby, I Ain't Holding Your Hand. I mean, that's right out of Haunting, The Haunting. Robert Wise is The Haunting.
Yeah,
I know those were jokes, but...
You and Abe almost did an episode on that film.
Oh, the original The Haunting? Yeah. But yeah, I mean... You know, the whole tree rape thing, but of course the trees are also very Wizard of Oz. I think if you really looked at this film, and we're also seeing Sam Raimi like early on, right, in his career. So he was really playing with things and trying to see what was working. But those were the images that disturbed me the most. I did have a couple of problems with this. One of them was the bridge.
Yeah.
Being just torn up, and then, oh, but there's this trail. Okay. So how the hell does the trail get over the ravine? Is there a bridge up there? Like that, you know, But like any horror movie, you just kind of take it with a grain of salt and you go, they're just trying to tell a story here. You just go with it. So,
yeah, there's a lot of things in this film that just, you got to kind of go with the flow.
Yeah. And I found particularly most of the problematic moments for me are earlier in the movie. I think the movie gets stronger the further in you get. Whereas right. by the time you get to the end, I'm totally on board. It's that first thing, and like, remember I was talking about Bruce Campbell's acting skills. That scene at the bridge too was not a great high point in acting history.
Oh, when he's screaming,
when
he's
just screaming, no! It's like, okay.
Speaking of acting, the part where Henrietta is a human and she talks about how it was so strange that it was snowing in November or whatever, and that whole scene was I felt disturbing because we know it's not her and yet she is so sincere, and it just like kind of freaked me out when I saw it at the theaters. And then of course, you know, she turns into the
right.
And then don't forget, Eric, they talk about on the tape when they're playing back the tape from the professor. He says he had to kill her and she had turned into a demon. It's like, holy shit.
Yeah. Well, and I was just going to say that's also from the original film, is that after some of the people get possessed, they seem okay for a moment and then everything goes apeshit again. So. Yeah, that's a particularly disturbing concept. The fact that somebody could be possessed and then unpossessed and then maybe repossessed. They take them away because you haven't made your payments. No, that whole thing, I agree. Because you know that they shouldn't trust her. But you get how Annie wants to trust her. That's her mom. She wants to believe, and that's why Ash has to grab her and then shake his head. He's like, no, don't fall for it.
Yep. He has to hold her back and all that. And then, of course, you know, they threw him back down there. Which was the best. And he's like, get me out of here. But I. there was a. What was it? Speaking of the cellar scene, another thing from the documentary was they had the poster of Nightmare on Elm Street on the wall up down there. Or was it Friday?
No, they had his glove in the work.
Yeah, as he's heading down when he heads down to get the pages, there's Freddy's glove is hanging by the door. I thought I had saw it, so I just paused it and rewound it, and yeah, it was definitely there. Because if I remember correctly, they have in the original Evil Dead, I think they have the poster for like The Hills Have Eyes. I think.
Yeah,
they might have something in there, and then in Nightmare on Elm Street, Wes Craven put the Evil Dead poster. And so this was putting – they put that in there, you know, so it's kind of a back and forth.
Right. So it was a wink to each other, which is kind of funny. Let's see. Now, Mike, what parts of this movie got you, whether it was the funny parts or the scary parts or something?
What always gets me in going back to the original Evil Dead – is a lot of it's the sound, and the camera, the sound of the, when you have the Raimi cam, you know, where he just has the camera on the 2x4.
The rumble
as it's moving through the woods.
Well, not to cut you off, but when the first time I saw the original Evil Dead, my television at the time, I didn't have a home theater set up. I just had like a 20-inch tube TV. But something about the frequency of the sound that he used for that and the way I had it set up on the stand I was using, that noise made like the entire setup shake and vibrate while I was going wah wah wah. So like the first time I was watching it, I was just like, holy shit, this is scary as shit. So sorry, continue. Yeah,
that noise. No, but that's it. And thank you for the sound effect. I mean, and really, I mean, that's not the only thing. There's stuff here that's good. In the first, there's more stuff, especially when it's not on a high resolution, where you can see the seams. There's stuff in the first that I think are in some ways the camera work that's more inventive. And was it Linda who's sitting there making the cackling noises? In that first one. So there's not much here that pegs me. Like I just cannot look at Henrietta and not see Ted Raimi, right? It just pulls me out of the film. Mm. That's not the film's fault. That's my fault for knowing Ted Raimi's face. but I just can't help but see Ted Raimi in there now, which makes me laugh.
I actually was surprised that it was a guy that played the monster Henrietta, because I didn't even know that until I saw the documentary like 10 years later when I bought the disc.
But now that I know Ted Raimi, because I've seen him in so many things now.
Yeah, he's become a cult actor. Yeah,
right. So, and it's still clearly his face underneath that makeup. But really that camera gets me, I guess that the tree stuff tends to get me when she's, being, wrapped up by the tree and the branches, and the branches are going in her mouth. 'Cause we don't see the tree rape this time. Mm-hmm. It's more classy implied tree sexual assault. But the branches going in her mouth, I don't know why that particularly bothers me.
And that was reverse motion acting.
Yeah.
Well, the branches going in her mouth, there's something, again, Raimi seems to play with a lot of basic imagery in here that is just particularly disturbing to the human condition. If you think about, like I said, the blank eyes that imply that there is no sense of reason anymore. If you think about things like branches going into people's mouths, that plays on a couple of real primal fears. One of them, of course, is choking, which is pretty obvious. The other is being penetrated. It is inherently sexual, even though it is going through the mouth. We do talk about the rape scene, but still, anything going into an open orifice in your body is violating.
Yeah.
Right. Whether it's going into your mouth or your anus or, your vagina, whatever those parts may be, your ear. It's that whole idea of being sharply violated without your consent.
Yeah. Well, for example, like the first Alien film, they played on the pretty much rape, mm-hmm. rape by extraterrestrial, it's a lot of the creature was based off phallic and sexual imagery from H.R. Giger. A human is raped through the throats by an alien creature and forcibly impregnated.
Mm-hmm.
There's also like a shot of Lambert being cornered by this creature and the tail kind of moving between her legs and stuff like that. There's just imageries like that kind of plays on the invading of flesh in space.
Are you trying to say that when the robot Ash takes a magazine, rolls it up into a tube, and tries to shove it into Sigourney Weaver's mouth, that's somewhat sexually influenced?
Well,
I think Ridley Scott said so, yeah.
Yes. So for more on the various phallic imageries, I highly recommend you tune in to our Alien episode that was actually mentioned earlier, which is something like episode 75 of the Dark Discussions podcast, available on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play,
Spotify,
iHeartRadio, and through the website Podbean. And every place else, Podbean, Overcast. You can go download it from there and listen to that, and you'll hear all about the sexuality of the movie Alien that you may have overlooked or
blocked out.
Maybe if you were watching the movie with your eyes closed.
Or like it was just something you watched when you were young and naive and right. never bothered opening your eyes, you know, from the adult point of view. Yeah, it's highly recommended. But yeah, it's certainly it. Yeah, other than that, so it doesn't catch me. That's why, again, I think the first one I find scarier, the second one I find funnier. This is a really interesting blend. And I love the film. It is still – and I think it's a better film than Army of Darkness. I just don't like it as much.
I disagree with that statement, but whatever.
Yeah. I honestly need to rewatch Army of Darkness, and for years – at least for the last, since I've been doing this podcast, I have said to myself on many an occasion, oh my gosh, I seriously need to watch Army of Darkness. I need to go see it again. And I haven't. Part of me is afraid to, because I just remember that, mind you, I barely remember any of what went on in that movie. However, all I remember is thinking, oh my God, that was the funniest thing I've ever seen. I'm almost afraid to watch it. Because I don't want that memory to be ruined for me. If I watch it now and go, oh, what the hell was I thinking? It's kind of going to ruin that magical memory for
me.
Oh,
I don't think that'll be the case. I think I've owned 4 different versions of that movie on disc.
So about 1% of the different versions that have come out.
No, I had a version of the Boomstick edition on DVD. It was a dual disc. And then I've had 3 different Blu-rays, I think. Yeah.
I actually saw that one at theaters, too. I was excited about it and was very disappointed with it because it was, wasn't...
It's mostly a comedy.
Scary. Yeah, right. I mean, it was a few scenes, like 20 minutes. I said, all right, this is really good. It got that creepy, gothic, scary stuff. And then it turns into more of a comedy. But, yeah, I mean, looking back and knowing what it is, I like it now. But I was hoping it would be another Evil Dead 2. And, again, I was looking at Evil Dead 2 as more true horror than comedy.
See, because to me, Army of Darkness is a comedy and it's trying to be a comedy. Evil Dead is a horror movie and it's trying to be a horror movie. And Evil Dead 2 doesn't quite know what it is. And that's why I think it's my least favorite.
You know what? I have to agree with you, Eric, because as someone who's never seen this before, I'm sorry, Abe, but as someone who's never – I interrupted you. As someone who's never seen this before, I very much – that unevenness in tone – really did bother me. I was kind of like, okay, am I supposed to laugh now? Because I was just terrified. And now we're going to be goofy. And now what the hell is this? And now he's sitting there going, groovy. And I'm like, okay. But yeah, I kind of wish it had been either a little more even keeled about it, where it's terrifying but has its moments of humor. Or it's strictly humorous, but has its very terrifying moments. I think it was just a little bit too much of both to be temperate. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It definitely did juggle the tones a lot. As I mentioned, when it kind of went back, certain scenes were felt like they were playing straight horror, and other times they were trying to mix it, and other times they were going for more straight-up comedy. I mean, because, you know, the scene where Harry Potter is dancing in the dark and attacking Ash, felt sort of more horror, as I said, but the scene where his hand is beating the living shit out of him was very Three Stooges.
Well, and oddly enough, Sam Raimi will be the first one to admit that the Three Stooges are a huge influence on his filmmaking.
Well, that's kind of a funny thing because they use a number of stunt doubles and stuff like that, but they always refer to these stunt doubles as fake shims.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Now, what did you guys think of the book and also the tape recorder? Because I felt that both of those things kind of made the movie scarier as well. Any thoughts?
I really liked the tape recorder a lot. But then again, you can always sucker me into anything with a good creepy legend and some esoteric scientist playing with things he shouldn't be playing with, and that doesn't matter what it is. I happen to think that that is an extremely effective horror trope. And like I said earlier, I liked how it was very clean. It's like, this is the book. It disappeared in the 1300s, the end. Like, we didn't get this whole long preamble about what was going on here and these people and that people. And it was very good. But I think also because that is such a standard trope, it really gave the movie the grounding you needed so that you as the viewer knew what to expect when this movie started. I wish they had been a little bit less heavy-handed with that opening scene of being like, this is the book. And it was, I don't know, it was just a little on the edge of silly to me. I wish it had been a little more serious. But other than that, I really liked it, and I think it gave us the grounded that we needed.
I think it's a little weird because, you know, they basically reusing the same exact plot line again from the first film, which happens a lot in this movie.
Yeah.
Because again, the first film, it's the same thing. Now, obviously, if you've not seen it, Chrissy, then it shouldn't matter. But it's this, you know, this time out, it's the daughter comes along and plays it and doesn't know what to hit stop. I don't have a problem with the fact that somewhere between movie one and movie two, the tape has rewound itself because I've figured the spirits have done it, you know, just, just to prime it up again. So, yeah, I mean, it's I don't think it's necessary so much to do it twice, which they kind of do. Like Chrissy said, they explain it to you in the before the credits what the book is, and then have another one like to explain to you in the tape. I think it would work a little better if they do one or the other. I don't think they need to do both. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think part of the reason that it's happening, of course, it had to do with the fact that they had to build up from scratch because of the rights issue. Because in the first film, everything is slowly building up within the 80 minutes. You know, the characters get to the cabin, they kind of settle down, and then they slowly discover the book, and then they sit around and kind of listen to the tape recorder, and then shit kind of starts from there. Here, they kind of had to go into overdrive to kind of get off to where the first film ended.
Right.
No, but I'm talking about the preamble that tells you about the book. And then they have the daughter, Annie, read from the book again later. I'm just saying I would have preferred them maybe finding a different way to do it, or, you know, they already had them right read from the book. Did they go over?
But when she reads from a book later, she's trying to counteract what happened with the tape.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but the daughter plays the tape. Is what I meant to say. Not reading from the book. The daughter plays the tape again.
Yeah,
it's not the same section of the tape, though.
No, that's when she learns about what happened to her mother. And
right. And also right. Bruce Campbell's character has already been thrown into the basement. I think he's a murderer.
Right, but I'm saying as far as giving information to the audience, you only needed to do the tape in the story. I don't think they needed the preamble for it.
Okay, I'll go with that.
Yeah. I mean, you could be right. They could have just had them show up at the cabin and they say, oh, what's this book, and start playing the recorder. But I do think that minute preamble is awesome myself. But I felt it was an excellent way to set up, like, you know, first of all, it has this thing warning this film could be intense for those people who, you know, may not want to view it. And then they have this weird rosebud flower in a horror film, to, you know, productions or whatever. And then suddenly you have this preamble of this book with blood and all these demonic images and esoteric writing and all this other stuff. It's like, this is pretty cool. And then within 10 minutes, you know, they play the tape and the tape's reading from the book, and it's like, oh, this is awesome. And then all hell breaks loose. So, I hadn't seen the first film, so I just went in to this film when I first saw it. And so it all was original to me. It was all scary to me, and it was all an impressive way to get demons to begin to attack. And I've always felt it was effective, but again, that's just me. But
I don't have a problem with the preamble. I kind of see Mike's point in that then when the girl reads the thing again, it's kind of like, okay, well, this is redundant because we as the audience already know that. So I get what he's saying there. They could have just changed that up a little bit. I think the preamble is a good idea because, like I said, I did not know anything about the Evil Dead at all. Well, even though I had seen Army of Darkness. So it was kind of funny because when they did this preamble, I have seen at horror conventions the book and all this around over the years, never really understood what it was. I was like, oh, this is what that book thing that I always see at these cons is about. Well,
and
so
Chrissy, if you might not remember this, but at the beginning of Army of Darkness, they pretty much give a summary of this movie in like 30 seconds.
Pretty much.
It got into my hand and went bad, so I cut it off with a chainsaw.
Okay,
stop it. Right. It came back.
Well, and I'm sure that they did that, but like I said, I saw it when it came out. I don't remember the small details. However, me not realizing that movie was actually, one in a series, I probably sat there and went, oh, okay, I don't know what the hell he's talking about, but whatever, move on. Like, I know I never made that connection. Because when I found out years ago that Army of Darkness was connected to the Evil Dead movies, I went, oh my God, really? I was like, I had no idea.
And if you try and watch these movies in a row, there's an awful lot of retconning going on between part two and part one, and part three and part two. So the whole thing gets rewritten as it's going along too. It's kind of weird.
Right, right. It is getting rewritten, and absolutely, because at the end of this film here, he's a hero and he's the chosen one. And then the beginning of the next one, they beat him up and put him in jail.
Yeah. He's a war criminal.
But the thing that I liked about them reading the book a second time, Mike, was first of all, they switched perspectives from characters. And because even though Bruce Campbell's character was important for the first like 20 minutes of the film, I felt when I was first watching this film, since I had no idea about Evil Dead, the first film, I assumed the daughter was going to be the lead character. And so when she shows up and she starts playing the tape, and we're finding out that the professor killed his wife because she became possessed, and then that tape unleashes Henrietta. I don't know. I just thought it was friggin' awesome.
When I watched the movie, They cut from everything that's been going on with Ash to an airport. I'm like, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah. That
Who
was
is
so
this
weird.
Person and why do I care? It took me a second to catch up and figure out where they were going with it.
Gotcha. Yeah. Because they said they're going to the cabin to talk to her father about the book. Mm-hmm. And then that's how you get your connection. Yeah.
Exactly. They were going to talk to her about what?
They're going to talk to her father and mother at the cabin. They
about
haven't heard
what?
From them about the book.
About what?
He's trying to get you to say it, Phil.
Oh, Necronomicon.
No.
Yes, Phil, you go. You did it.
No. The about the what? The what?
The
Phil, come on. You're stomping on a tradition here.
2 days later.
In a book.
Oh,
thank you. Okay.
Yes. I was.
That
I was
wasn't clear though, Mike. It should be a minute together.
I know. Yeah. I was trying. Yeah, I was trying.
Reaching on that one.
I know.
Effort.
I tried. Actually, one of the things I liked, I realized watching it. I don't know if you pick it up that there's an odd thing to it with the whole idea of the sanctuary of the home. Or in this case, the cabin, because well, the cabin isn't a safe place. It's safer than being outdoors, and I always kind of like the idea of being trapped in a place. But if you really, unless I'm missing something until the end, basically, if you're in the cabin, one of the demons, they're kind of stuck in the cabin. Mm-hmm. If you're out of the cabin, you're stuck out of the cabin. You can't pass through the walls.
Yeah.
That's not true, I don't
know. Well, if it possesses somebody,
uh-huh,
it tends to come in. Well, that's right. There's the camera that follows Ash in, right? Or
yeah.
There's a weird moment, though, when the character Ed suddenly gets possessed out of nowhere, and we don't even see the Force show up.
Right.
Well, I'm not sure how that one happened, because usually there's a contact thing, like getting bitten on the hand.
Yeah.
Right. As a possession. So I didn't pick up exactly how he got.
Maybe he just gave up on life.
Yeah, maybe.
Oh, you remember? Yeah, he did. He got grabbed by Henrietta and thrown against a wall. Remember? And he was unconscious, right, and he was bleeding from
the head. And Henrietta was already in the house.
Right. Yeah, she was in the house. Yeah.
Henrietta's in the house.
And it was the entities in the house too, because you know they were possessing the animal head and all this other stuff too. So,
but they didn't actually. But those things didn't actually do anything, right? The animal head couldn't do anything to Ash, or at least as far as we know.
Right. Right. Only Henrietta was inside the house that could actually do anything to people,
and his own hand.
Oh, and one thing, I'm just on that. One of the things I really liked, and it never struck me before when I watched this, was when the chair's rocking,
mm-hmm,
and Ash reaches out to touch to see if there's anything in the chair.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right.
I thought that was such a neat thing, because it makes perfect sense that someone would go, what the?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something there? Is there something tangible there? And it just makes it even more kind of creepy than just what a normal person, which is like, look and go, oh my God, their chair is rocking on its own. It's that need to get closer to it and touch it. And that really, that skeevy to the audience.
Right. Right. Yeah. And the sound effects too. It's like a little ding from a harp or something as he's putting his hand out to touch it. And it was a good effect, I felt, too, mm-hmm, the sound design. Yeah.
Well, and another thing that I like, I really liked the makeup they had on Bruce Campbell when he was possessed.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was, yeah, that was fairly effective.
Yeah. The dark eyes and awesome. Right at the beginning where he's kind of like blackened the first time he gets possessed.
Right, right. And then he has the like the sunken.
It was really well done.
Yeah. I also liked how the inside of the basement, you know, like the remake, they had like dead cats hanging and all that other stuff. But they just have innocuous things like
gourds.
All the gourds. Yeah. And it's like, what are the gourds?
Fruit cellar or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
well,
that's exactly
what it is. Talk about cellar, right? Like it's all the fruit cellar. Yeah, they do say that. But
yeah,
I thought.
Yeah.
But again, that just ties in with the whole idea of less is more. You know, sometimes doing less with an environment like that. Like I love, like someone was saying how just a few minutes ago, how the cabin is sort of sacred, right? It's a safe place. It's somewhere that people are safe. It's isolated. What I think is so really cool about that is it's the same principle as in Poltergeist, right? He took part of what was groundbreaking about what he did with that movie was he took your average non-scary, suburban, clean, lovely home and turned it into hell. And that's kind of what he does here. He takes this magical cabin that's really like charming and homey and cozy and in the woods. And normally it would be a wonderful little vacation place to escape and makes it a prison, but doesn't really put anything scary in it.
Right.
Nothing in there scary. I mean, the lights are always on. That was another thing. Whenever you saw it from the distance, the lights were always on.
Yeah. No, what he does is he turns innocuous things into scary things. Like, mm-hmm. the church clock and the animal head and the lights and the China doors for the China cabinet and mm-hmm. and just things like that, and it makes the I mean, that's why it keeps on reminding me of the films from the 50s and 60s, the haunted house films from those years, because it takes all those tropes and makes them scary again. Because, you know, we've seen those tropes all the time, and, you know, they're not scary anymore. And like you said, Chrissy, going what Poltergeist did, turning a modern thing into something that's hell. You know, the gothic stuff from the 40s, 50s, and then all the writings way back made those type of things, these cabins, scary. And I think this movie brought that back after, like, that had fallen out of vogue when the slashers and the grindhouse films took over in the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's the funny thing is that this is, in theory, a grindhouse film, but it's taking tropes from gothic horror as well as grindhouse and merging them together, I feel. But anyway, now what I felt that the image of, you know, the savior in the book and all that, and then finding out at the end without anybody saying it that he was the savior, I was like, no way. I thought that was awesome ending.
It was pretty cool. Too bad they like retconned it at the beginning of the next movie.
I absolutely just loved Bruce Campbell's reaction right at the end. He's just like, no. Just like, he's deeper into this shit now.
Right. Yeah, I'm curious how that played at the time. Because actually, of the three, it was actually, I've neglected to mention, Army of the Darkness was the first one I'd seen. Because in hindsight, at least, it seems really obvious that that's a picture of Ash.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, obviously, he's got the chainsaw, and what's supposed to look like he's holding up a saw. But that's just, like, really obvious to me. I don't know, having already seen Army of Darkness and knowing what Ash becomes, I'm curious how obvious it was, like, on a first viewing.
Well, when I was watching it with a commentary, like, Bruce Campbell was upset because the drawing in the book has him wearing white pants. And apparently the artist that had do the drawings for the book showed up on a day when they weren't actually shooting. They were just rehearsing, so he wasn't in full costume, and he was wearing white pants, and that's why they drew it that way. And he's like, son of a bitch, I'm supposed to have brown pants.
I didn't even notice that either. But I did not get it that it was him until I saw the last, you know, 20 seconds of the film, and I was like, no way, that's awesome. But yeah, that is kind of funny that he had white pants. What did you think of that giant monster head that came in through the front door?
I loved that. Awesome.
That was really cool.
I loved it. I thought that was the best part of the movie.
The slave heads on it too. But yeah, what are you gonna say?
Yeah, I also just loved the little shot of Bruce Campbell's hair just going white in the flowers next to him wilting. I just really, you know, it was a really cool little scene. And with all the trees slamming down the house and stuff like that, it was a really cool finale.
It was. And then the daughter opens the gate, and she does at the end. But the thing is that the
she died the saving the world.
Yeah, that's true. Ash got sucked in. He got. That's right, he says that, doesn't he? But he gets sucked in, the poor bastard.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what else. Is there anything else?
I've said pretty much everything I have to say about this movie.
Pretty much same here.
Well, that's the thing, is that this movie, one of our Patreon supporters and a good friend of the podcast that's listened to us for years, he actually mentioned that. He says, oh no, Evil Dead 2 is going to win the poll because, you know, how many times has this film been talked about? So obviously we're trying to, you know, mix it up with our own perspective and our own fun with the film, as well as all the stuff that everybody knows about the film, which is everything that's you can see on the disc with the commentaries and all that. So hopefully we at least put a different spin on you know, a movie that everybody has talked about, basically, you know.
Well, I don't know if we succeeded, but we talked about the movie people voted for, so they can't complain.
Yeah, I'm just looking through my notes for a second. So I'm pretty sure that my wife was happy to see Linda go because she was wearing a Michigan State shirt. So
yep.
She's probably happy about that.
My office has a first huge – I live right down the street from the University of Michigan, and my office has a huge Michigan State versus U of M war going on internally.
My wife is Illinois.
Okay.
There was a shot. We talked about some cool shots, and like, I'm not sure. I don't know if this was intentional or how they did it, or if I was seeing things. But there's the shot of where there's the clouds over the moon.
That was ink in a fish tank.
Is that? But also, was it just me, or did it have like almost a skull like look to it at first, or was I completely hallucinating?
I didn't get that.
The only time I remember Skull was like when the weird face kind of hovers over the shape of the cabin, and the voice says, "Join us."
Okay. No, I thought I saw a face, and the human eye picks up faces all sorts of places. That was a Dr. Seuss book, I think. Maybe I was just seeing something. And there was one other thing I was going to mention. I don't remember what it was. Oh, the skeleton at the end. When Ash goes into the basement.
Jake skeleton.
I never realized I was Jake skeletons, but until this time, and I saw it. I didn't. That's what I was about to say. I never saw the overalls before. I do think it's nice that if you look, at Annie and what's the boyfriend's name. The preppy fashion, right, is very different from 1986, but the redneck fashion of a plaid shirt and coveralls that stays the same. That has not changed. God bless the rednecks for being consistent.
Right.
You can take a redneck from 1986, plop him down into a 2019 film, and nobody would say that's a fashion faux pas.
And the chick too, because she yes. wore the, you know, the crop top and the Daisy Dukes and the stuff. Yeah, so you're right. The rednecks are timeless.
And you know what? If you want to learn more about rednecks, I highly recommend that you go look to see if Joe Bob Briggs is doing a show of how rednecks stay in Hollywood somewhere near you, because I know he's kind of doing some tours around the country here and there. If you get a chance to go see it, it's a great show. Well worth watching.
Oh yeah, that was the best $20 I spent this year. That's for sure. No doubt about it. All right, so I guess we can wrap up. Unless, let me just throw it out once more. Anybody else? Any other things anybody wanted to bring up that we forgot? That's on your notes. Anyone?
All right. We hit everything.
So, before we. Give our final thoughts. Eric, you actually do another podcast for your buddy Dan?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askanci Podcast. That's spelled Askanci. You can find it everywhere you can find this podcast except iHeartRadio. I'm not on there. I don't even know how to apply to get on there. I got to figure that out.
Speaking of Eric probably should be in the Guinness Book of World Records for doing more podcasts than anybody in the history of the world.
Oh, I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
There are people out there who have done many more podcasts than I have.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know there's some people who do.
400 Askancities?
No, I know Ben Lindbergh does the Effectively Wild Baseball podcast, and that for a while was daily, and they're at over episode 1,000. I don't, and he's missed very few of those.
Joe Rogan way more podcasts than me.
don't get me wrong. Eric is pretty high on that list. And I think if you did purely volunteer podcasts that are not in any way related to employment, somebody who does 150 podcasts plugging their book, you know, I think Eric could possibly have that title, but he's up there.
Yeah, as far as being sure motivated by mental illness rather than financial gain.
Oh dear!
Right. Exactly. All right, so people should check that podcast out. I think, let's see, Chrissy, you have a new book out that you are promoting?
I do. My new book is called The Shadows Behind. You can pretty much get it wherever books are sold. And I write short dark fiction, and you can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
Excellent. Very good. And Mike, probably next week instead of this week, our new podcast is coming out. What's that?
That would be Cinema a la Carte. And the first episode has not yet been released. And that first episode is the movie Frontier. No, not Frontier.
Hostile.
I'm sorry. Different horror movie name.
With an S on the end. Hostile without an S is a different movie.
It was the non-horror hostile movie, the one with the rape and murder and torture. No, wait a minute. But yeah. So it is Hostile.
Hostile with a Z.
Starring Christian Bale, who's doing his best Tom Hardy, deep, rough, mumbly, I can't understand a word he's saying voice. Who else was in that?
Rosamund Pike and Christian Bale's mustache.
And, Scott Wilson.
Speaking of Scott Wilson?
Scott, the guy from Walking Dead, the old man that died.
Yeah. I think that's his name. It was his last film, actually.
Yes, it was.
And speaking of that film, 6 Degrees to Kevin Bacon, the cinematographer of Evil Dead 2, directed Hostile 3, which has no relations to Hostiles.
Well, thanks. I guess.
Yeah. All right. So let's give our final thoughts on Evil Dead and our 400th episode of Dark Discussions. And let's start with you, Abe.
I really enjoy this film. It's a lot of fun. It's got a lot of cheese to it, but it's got a lot of heart to it as well. There's some really cool effects, some really awesome scenes, some fun ones, some silly ones. It's a good film to sit down at Halloween and have a good laugh and a good scare with. It's a classic. I would check that out in the other Evil Dead films. I'm glad we finally talked about it. And a happy 400th episode, everybody, because, wow, what a long road it's been for us. And I'm interested to see where it takes us down in the future.
Very good. For me, I'll be rewatching it in less than 35 days from now because when October comes around, it'll be one of the films I'll watch during the month of October. So I'll be rewatching it then. I think it's, even though it has its funny moments, it's an effective horror film and one of the best ones out there, both as, I guess, now a classic regular film, never mind as a classic grindhouse film. I think it's something that everybody probably has already seen, and if you haven't, you're in for a treat. Check it out. Chrissy?
I truly enjoyed this movie. I have probably the same sentiments as everyone else. I think it's fun. I think there are some genuinely frightening moments in this. Definitely give it a chance. and, you know, enjoy. I think it's the perfect film for a Halloween party for sure. Or if you're just having people that you want to hang out with. But also do beware, too, that if you are sensitive to certain imagery, like I am, there's some stuff in here that despite the fact it's like old school, kind of corny looking effects, dude, that stuff is scary. Don't be surprised if you have some nightmares. But yes, I recommend, especially with Halloween coming up.
All right, Eric.
Yeah, Evil Dead 2 is a good movie. I like it, although I like the other Evil Dead movies better. I would recommend it. I would particularly recommend it to aspiring filmmakers, because Sam Raimi does a lot of cool shit on a relatively small budget. So yeah, if somehow you've never seen this movie, check it out.
Very good. And Mike?
First of all, I had a conservative guess of 90 minutes per. Then after 400 episodes, you could listen to Dark Discussions 25 days straight without an ounce of sleep in order to get through the entire thing.
Oh, Jesus. Hour and a half. When we ever stopped after an hour and a half?
I said conservatively speaking. And it made the math easier. With that said, also at 90 minutes is The Evil Dead 2, which I got to say, I think the Evil Dead or Ash trilogy or whatever you want to call it is arguably one of the most solid beginning to end movie trilogies that's ever been made. And even though its tone slides into more silliness as the series goes on, it is remarkably consistent in its quality. And we have now covered officially, I guess, two of the four Evil Dead films. We did do the remake, and I guess we touched on the original a bit in the remake episode, yeah, right? If you want to hear us discuss the original Evil Dead, which is going to be next on Chrissy's list, or Army of Darkness, then I highly recommend you contribute to Patreon and, shameless plug. And donate and put it down on your list of recommendations, and maybe you'll get that'll get picked up later. But yeah, it's like I said, it is my least favorite of the three films, but it's still so much to enjoy. That is a very minor criticism because I love all three of these movies for different reasons.
It's like saying your least favorite Quentin Tarantino movie.
No, because I really didn't care for Hateful Eight.
Wow. Okay.
And I don't
although I have to rewatch
Quentin Tarantino movies except for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So I don't know how
I was not trying to make a controversial statement. I was trying to make a joke. Move on.
Wait. Hateful Eight was no good.
Move on. Move on. Right. We're not moving on.
Yes, I'm trying to move on. And I would say actually of the films, this is the one that probably most relies purely on Raimi's talent as a director, because there isn't much of a story there, and it is propelled so much through visuals. The first film does a lot creatively with visuals as well, and is much more experimental because he's a young director and he's just trying shit, but he's also much more limited by money than he was with Evil Dead 2, which he was also limited by money, but not as much. So he just does a lot of stuff, and you know, the mixture of practical effects and stop motion animation, and whatever he can to get the image that he wants, you know, that degree of creativity is phenomenal. And there's again 742 different discs of it out there, and each of them has a unique commentary track, even though they're all by Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell anyway. But I'm sure there's a lot of documentaries about it. There's lots of behind the scenes stuff that you can watch and should watch if you never have, if you really want to know how they did the things that they did. So this is about the highest recommendation for a horror fan as you can have.
All right. Very well. So 32-year-old movie, 1987's Evil Dead 2, the film that made the, or I guess brought the careers of many people to be noticed by Hollywood. the film is, like I said, is readily available on very many different versions of the disc, and most of them are cheap, meaning around $10, because it's owned by Lionsgate now, so they're usually pretty good. After a film is over a year old, they usually drop their prices down to $10, and sure enough, they did for this, and it's loaded with extras. And the film is considered a classic, so everybody should see it. Once again, for listeners, thanks for joining us for our 400th episode of the podcast. And for those new and old, we appreciate you listening, because without you, we'd just be talking to open air. And pretty much that's what we were doing the first 30 or 40 episodes of the podcast. Every podcast is pretty much like that, especially back 10 years ago when we started doing the podcast, because, back then, the internet and Facebook and all that stuff wasn't really around. And now, of course, there's hundreds of great podcasts out there, some that talk about horror just as us, and we welcome them as well, and people should listen to any and all as they can. So with all that stated...
And I want to point out, I don't know if we have mentioned this on the podcast, but yes. I guess you were... This came up at the meeting at Mystic. You know, for starting out, 8 years ago, 8 years and 399 episodes ago, I guess you were told in the month of July, and we weren't even done with the month of July, that our website, the darkdiscussions.com website, had 100,000 hits on it.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That's pretty freaking phenomenal.
For just the month of July.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, we were trying to determine why. One reason could have been the help of a Mr. or, as I'll just call him, the Ranger, promoting the episodes. And that was the time when we had interviewed him and talked about that movie that he starred in. And that could have been part of the reason. But again, though, I haven't found out what our hits were for months prior to that either. So it was only because I was talking to our internet provider, and he mentioned it in passing to me.
Yeah, so. I left all of that stuff out when I wrote a letter to Shudder and just mentioned that we were a podcast at 100,000 hits in the month of July alone. So totally cherry-picking information.
Yep, as most marketers do.
Yeah, that's... And Mike wrote that Shudder?
Well, you posted something on Facebook and tagged Shudder, didn't you?
What?
Didn't you do that?
Attack Shudder? Absolutely not.
No, tag Shudder.
Tag Shudder. Maybe I know. I wrote something. I wrote Shudder because of the. Which, by the way, if you want to watch Shudder, and I highly recommend it for free for 30 days, you can use the code SCARES. And I was writing them because
right.
I'm already a subscriber.
Yeah.
I cannot use the code SCARES as somebody who's already subscribed to them for the next year. So I wrote into them to express my support for both Shudder and for SCARES the Care. And I may have accidentally dropped the fact that we have 100,000 listeners and we often promote Shudder on the podcast.
If they want to sponsor us.
I'd go there because that wasn't the purpose. However, if they were willing,
I didn't even see this.
I didn't. I it was an email. It wasn't an online post.
Are you sure? I swear to God, I read this on Facebook.
I had mentioned some stuff, but I had not posted that online.
Okay.
And I did hear back from them a couple of days later, asking what I was proposing. I was like, I wasn't proposing anything. However, if someone would get the monthly figures, maybe something could be proposed.
Well, so they were interested in something, Mike?
I don't know. We can discuss
that offline.
We can talk offline.
All right. Yeah, very well. All right. So sounds good. So I guess with all that said, Eric, why don't you leave us up?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening to episode number 400. Come back for episode 583. That's the number at random.
It was attempted at a joke. That's okay.
Oh, dear.
All right. Okay. It happens. They're not all hits.
I still have a better hit rate than Mike.
4 years ago, in this quiet forest, in this cozy cabin, something happened. Something so frightening. Something so deadly. Something so evil. We prayed it would never happen again. Now, from the creator of Evil Dead comes Evil Dead 2. Dead by Dawn.